I am pleased to introduce Senator Wyden. Ron Wyden was the first elected to Congress in 1980 to represent Oregon's 3rd District. In 1996, he was elected to the U.S. Senate in a special election, becoming the first U.S. Senator to be elected by vote by mail election. He was sworn in February 5th, 1996, to a seat once held by his mentor, U.S. Senator Wayne Morse. I'm proud to have Ron Wyden as my U.S. Senator. He serves all Oregonians with wisdom, tenacity, and hard work. He believes in and practices good governance. When he was elected to U.S. Senator in 1996, he promised to do a town hall in every county every year. After more than 750 town halls, let's welcome U.S. Senator Ron Wyden to town hall number 799.
Thank you. Catherine, thank you so much. And what a thrill to look out at this crowd, because this is what the founding fathers thought representative democracy ought to look like. This is exactly what they had in mind. How many of you have never been to one of our town meetings before? Raise your hands. Well, lots of newcomers. Great. Well, for those of you that have never been, I usually start off talking a little bit, like maybe 40, 45 minutes. People think that's a lot of fun. And some folks over there think I'm serious. Their face got all pale and they're trying to figure out how they might get to run out the door. This is what I say is what democracy is supposed to be about. I'm going to listen to what you all have to say. I'll do my best to try to give responses. It's what I said I would do. I know that sounds like a quaint idea, but I said that if I had the honor to be chosen Oregon's first new United States Senator in 30 years, I'd throw open the doors of government, and so every county, every year is going to be heard, and I'm not going to be reading from any teleprompters or anything like that. And sometimes we talk about the topic or two to begin with, but since there's such a big crowd for Clatsop, I think we'll just go right to Ms. Price calling questions. No subjects off limits, and let's just hear what's important to you.
Okay, great. Red 164, red 164, and...
And often the students get really bashful, and their names get called, and they don't ask their question. And a couple of meetings ago, there were a bunch of students in the front, and one of them knew that their friend had the ticket. And the friend said, "You better ask your question. I hear this guy might come to your house if you don't." But let's just have some fun. Let's talk about what's important to you.
So red, red 164, raise your hand and don't be shy, and blue 806.
Hi. My question is, even through the Obama administration, the House and the Senate were red, even though we had a blue president. And now we're a completely red country. And so my question is, what is the Democratic strategy to stay relevant in a really red America right now?
Good. I'll say right at the outset, we decided about 798 town meetings ago that these are official town meetings. These are not for like the Democrats or the Republicans and who's going to be the DNC chair and who's going to be this and that. And I'll be glad to talk to people after the meeting's over if they want to talk about some politics. But, you know, the basic question is a very good one. I mean, you don't send people to Washington, D.C. to fill a chair. I mean, you send them there to make a difference on the important issues. And so I will tell you that what I've come to feel is that my approach in Washington, D.C., and this was true even before Donald Trump was president, was to practice something that I call the Oregon Way. And we just have a different approach, as you know. We're much more independent than many parts, you know, of the country. We like to think, you know, creatively, some might say out of the box. We're compassionate, we're innovative. And that's what Democrats have done and what Republicans have done. Some of you students might not remember them, but I know adults will remember Mark Hatfield, our legendary Republican senator, Tom McCall, our very outspoken former Republican governor. You young people might not remember all that, but that's what I call the Oregon, you know, way. So part of the Oregon way for me is when something comes up, and this speaks directly to your question about being relevant, that strikes me as being kind of outside the Oregon way, I say, what I'm going to do is speak out, push back, and I'm going to offer, or try to, a smart alternative. And let me give you an example from a week ago. Did some of you happen to see a fella on TV from the Trump administration named Steve Miller? So among other things, he said, the power of the president shall not be questioned. Never heard of that being part of the Oregon way. He also said that 3 million people voted illegally in the last election. And I was asked by the news media what I thought of that. I said, there's not a shred of evidence of it, not a shred. But if the Trump administration insists on believing that 3 million people voted illegally, they should support my bill to take Oregon's vote by mail national. And the reason why, and it responds directly to this argument that, oh, there's so much fraud, is we have the paper trail for every ballot that's cast, number one. And number two, I can't tell you they're ready to go, but I'm talking to some very conservative Republicans right now in the Congress about this idea. And some of them are real security hawks. And given the fact that the Russians hacked our institutions, and that was what the intelligence people were talking about in October, I'm not going to tell you that we're ready to go and we got it passed and all the rest. But that's my idea of answering your question. You'll decide at the end of the day if you say, oh, you know, Ron's just back there fooling around with this or that or something else. But what I've always said is I don't agree with anything. I'll speak out, I'll push back, and I'll try to offer a smart alternative, and that's something that came up just in the last week.
Blue 806. No? Blue 768.
Are the adults bashful or the students? Who's being bashful here?
Blue 757. Wow.
You guys don't want me to come to your house.
Blue 764.
Okay, here we go.
Based on your committee membership, you obviously have information that we don't have. Given that, are you encouraged to dig even deeper into understanding what the Russian connection is with the administration? Thank you.
Question was about Russia, and I do serve on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. My older child calls it the so-called Intelligence Committee. And we are going to be leading the investigation, our committee, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, into Russia. And I think it's one of the most important things I've ever been part of. And I'm going to take a minute or two and kind of walk people through this. And like, you know, kind of you say, hey, you know, we're in Astoria, you know, what's the big deal? What does this have to do with us? Now, the first thing I can tell you is that decades of presidents, Democrats and Republicans, if you had Vladimir Putin, who's from the Soviet KGB, as you know, his roots, doing things like the Ukraine and Crimea and the human rights violations and poisoning journalists, the past presidents would have been going after that in a very strong way, starting with various kinds of sanctions, but we would have made it very clear that that is unacceptable. Donald Trump, we haven't heard a word from. Not a critical word with respect to Russia. And in fact, what we know, because it's come out in a number of reports, that the family has had very significant investments in the past with Russians. So the question is, for people in Astoria, or Sisters, where I was a couple days ago, or Hermiston, or wherever, as well as Tallahassee and Chicago and Louisville, the question is, does the president have financial interests that he might have a conflict of interest on, that he might have a conflict of interest relative to your interests? So, we then ought to factor in the fact that this is the first president in 40 years since Watergate who has not been willing to release his tax returns. Now, the reason that's a big deal, not just the fact that everybody's done it for 40 years, every Democrat, every Republican, every liberal, every conservative, 40 years, is for a presidential nominee or a president, releasing your tax returns is the lowest ethical bar. In other words, this is not the high ones, folks. This is the lowest ethical bar. So, you look at the history with respect to Russia. You look at the family's past in terms of investments with the Russians, and you say it's especially important to see the current president's tax returns, not just because everybody's done it for 40 years, but because they could tell us, in fact, whether or not he had investments that might pose, you know, a conflict of interest. So I've introduced federal legislation to require that nominees and presidents release their taxes, and I'm going to stay at that until we get it done. One. Two, with respect to the investigation, particularly into the connection between the Russians and any Trump political operations, I've insisted that there be open hearings as part of this, that the committee have subpoena power, that there's the opportunity to declassify information. I'm doing this because I think this goes right to the heart of a government's credibility, the confidence people can have in the government, the very legitimacy of our government. Lots of people think these investigations are going to get swept under the rug, nobody's ever going to do anything. I want to tell you here in Clatsop County today, on my watch, this investigation is so important, I will not let it be swept under the rug. It will not be swept under the rug.
Red 162. Okay, Red 138.
Are these all the students? All right, you guys. Well, let me just ask you guys one. So it's Friday night. It's some parties tonight or a game or something? Maybe a movie, pizza? Anybody going on a date? All right, now we know you're holding back. But let's say you're going to go out on a date tonight, hypothetically. My guess is one of the things you'd probably talk a lot about on a date, because you guys are 16 or 17 or 18, is that true for most of you? So, 18. So my guess is one of the things you definitely talk about is Medicare. No? I mean, it's only 50 years till you're eligible for it. But you guys would definitely talk about it, right? Okay. So now you guys have decided, you guys either kidding or he's just completely lost it. And I'm kidding, but barely. And let me tell you why. In terms of the federal budget, Medicare, the health care program for the elderly, is up here, and everything else is down here. Okay? That's because 10,000 people are going to turn 65 every day for years and years to come. That makes them entitled to Medicare. And if we don't figure out, and I've introduced some ideas that Democrats like and Republicans like, to make sure that seniors get the promise of Medicare, those guaranteed benefits, but we also find a way to get good quality care that's less expensive. And there is a lot of ways to do it, like more care at home rather than in nursing homes and the like. And here's the student connection. If we don't figure out how to do it, I tell all you guys, all you students, there's less money for student loans and education, less money for parks, less money for things like roads and transportation systems, but all the stuff you guys care about. So the point is, on a lot of this stuff, we're in it together. And of course, nobody on a date talks about Medicare. Senators are out of it. We're not that out of it. But the point is that these issues are very, very much connected. And that's why I really hope, whether it's health care or the ACA or education, financing college, or other things that are important to you, I need you guys to speak out. I want to hear from you and get educated. Do we have a student? That's a good sign.
Thank you for being here. I'd like to take a break from politics. I'm sure we'll hear enough about them. But as a 15-year-old, knowing that what is going on around me is extremely important, not only for my government, but for the people standing here with me today, what can I do as a 15-year-old to get involved with my country, to help my country now?
Good on you. What a great... What a great question. The first thing you're doing is some good work today, which is coming out and asking a question that's very much on point. And we really need to find ways to get more young people, you know, involved. And I think my view has always been that if you can just spend a few hours a week volunteering and pick the kind of area that you're interested in, you might be interested in environmental protection. There's lots of things that are important on the coast relating to protecting these wonderful treasures. Maybe you're interested in children, and you might like to read, for example, to youngsters of modest means. Maybe you want to work with, you know, the older folks. You want to help out on their programs. That was my background. I was director of the Senior Citizens for almost 7 years. And I went to school on a basketball scholarship. I was dreaming of playing in the NBA. It was a ridiculous kind of theory that I was going to be in the NBA because I was too small, and I made up for it by being really slow. So I wasn't going to get to play in the NBA. But what kind of got me going, apropos of your question, and I'm not proud of the fact that when I was in high school, I barely cracked the book. I'm not sure anybody could have got me to one of these kinds of things. Was I started volunteering with the older people. And back then, if a town like had a lunch program for senior citizens, that was considered like a big deal. There wasn't this whole network of services that there is today. So I'd really pick something that would kind of strike a chord with you, and not necessarily something you want to say, oh, I'm going to be a teacher, or I'm going to be a scientist, or I'm going to be this, or I'm going to be that. But just something where you said, if I spent a few hours a week and I could volunteer this way, I'd be able to make a big difference. And that's just a fact. It does make a difference, because as people get involved in their community and share ideas and the like, very often they might even come to a political figure and say, look at what we learned because we were volunteering. And I'll give you one example. I'm very concerned about the anti-hunger programs. We've already been getting rumors about various things being cut. So that's politics. What can you do? You can volunteer at the food bank and help out. And I'm telling you, that's really important. Because at the food banks today, we're often seeing families come in saying that they need help with food who not very long ago were volunteers at the program helping others. So let's give your friend a big round of applause. Great question. Great question. Great question.
Blue 735.
Thanks so very much for allowing us this great opportunity.
Can we just, before we go to that, I remembered that I had admitted our wonderful elected officials. Kathleen Sullivan, of course, has been here, and Cindy, we so appreciate her. But you've got Josh Marquis, your district attorney, is floating around. Where's Josh? Josh is in the back. We have Stephen Fulton, the Port of Astoria County Commissioner. Where is he? Great. And Tita Montero, Seaside City Council. Where's Tita? Okay. Thank you all. You know, you probably know Cindy and Tita. They're on the city council. They got a lot of perks. They get like a mansion, and they get a driver and a cook and all that kind of stuff. They get a tremendous number of perks. So you guys know I'm kidding again. Okay. But the reason they're doing this is not because they get any perks or aren't any of those kinds of things. They're doing it because they love your community. So really, let's have another shout out for your local folks. It's really great that they're helping. They are volunteers. They are volunteers.
I'm Jean Reitman. I moved here about 2 years ago. I'm a retired physician, and I come from a family and lots of generations of medical people. My immediate family has 250 years of combined medical experience and impeccable medical care, and we have never once been questioned or asked to volunteer for any input on any healthcare issues throughout our entire careers.
Well, consider yourself being asked today and in the days ahead.
Thank you. I got all the time in the world for you. We can fix it. We can get rid of the waste because we know where it is, no matter who's in government. It's not partisan.
And apropos of the physician's really good point, let me just give you an example. In this debate about the Affordable Care Act, the majority, the Republicans, have said that they're going to do this really partisan thing. It's called reconciliation. It's the most partisan thing. So I've said, look, if you guys are willing to set this partisan stuff aside, there are plenty of things that could be done to make the Affordable Care Act and we work better, and we could get Democrats and Republicans involved. Let me give you an example. As the physician knows, the big challenge in the Affordable Care Act marketplace is what's called the individual market. Right now, if you're with an employer plan, or you have a government plan, like you're on Medicare, you're in the VA and the like, yes, costs have gone up, but things have gone pretty well for you. The people that have had the big problems are the people in the individual insurance market. It'd be like a small business person or a contractor or something like that. It's only 6 or 7% of America, but they're really having problems. So I've told the Republicans, apropos of your point, for something Democrats and Republicans could work on together, I've said, look, if you guys will drop this partisan stuff, the first thing we would work on would be the individual insurance market, and we would enlarge the size of the insurance pools, because right now they're too small. And if they're small, there's not a very efficient way to spread the cost and the risk. So if you make the insurance pools bigger, you give those persons more bargaining power, A, the chance to hold their premiums down, B, and C, get more healthy young people into the pool. Those are the kinds of things we ought to be working on, not some partisan kind of thing that they call repeal and replace, and it's really more repeal and run. That would be the way I'd describe it.
Red 154.
Okay. Right there in the front.
So, with the new administration, there have been a lot of people saying that they, like, not my president. And there have been people in California getting signatures for a petition to put on their next ballot to secede from the union. What would Oregon's stance be if California were to do something like put that on the ballot? Would we be behind that or against it?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't be for that. Look, let's see if we can put some perspective around this. This morning as we meet here at Astoria High School, there are parents all over the world working 2-3 jobs, giving up their own meals for their kids, doing everything imaginable because they want only one thing, which is to have their child someday be able to come to the freest and most open country on earth. One. Two, there is nobody from here who wants to move there. And there's a lot of people there who want to move here. And the question is, so why is that? The reason why starts with this room. In much of the world, you can't have open, free meetings like this. Number one. Number two, if you ever said something that a senator didn't like, nobody'd probably ever hear from you again. So let's kind of keep this in perspective. We've got a lot to do here. There's no question about it, and I've already made it clear that I've certainly disagreed with a lot of the policies that have come from this new administration. And the reason I have is because, as I touched on earlier, I think they're pretty far removed from the Oregon way. Mark Hatfield, and some of you weren't born when he was here, was a legendary Republican. And I'll just tell you, if Mark Hatfield heard that there were going to be policies coming out of Washington, D.C., that were thinly veiled religious tests, Mark Hatfield would have said, no way, and so do I.
Blue 683. Blue 777.
I'm Annie from Gearhart, and I want to talk to you because Social Security and Medicare is part of my life. And I don't understand why the Congress never talks about the cap on Social Security payroll contributions. It's my understanding that if the cap's at $127,000, every millionaire and billionaire in this country has already stopped paying Social Security taxes for the year. Why can't we raise that cap so they pay their fair share like all the rest of us do?
So Annie from Gearhart is being a good citizen too. And great, great question. And we recently had a big, you know, healthcare, you know, rally, and there are a bunch of them going on across the country. And I said, look, the message is going to be real clear, and it's going to come from Democrats, Republicans, people of all political persuasions, and that is, we have taken the gloves off to say, hands off Medicare and Social Security. That's our kind of first message. Those are existing benefits. Now, you are asking about the future. I already mentioned, for me, on Medicare, the single biggest challenge is to recognize as the physician there who's going to end up being a volunteer, and she's probably going to say, be careful what you wish for. The challenge with Medicare is to update the Medicare guarantee. You know, when Medicare got going, it was like somebody broke their ankle or got a bad case of the flu. That's not Medicare. Today, Medicare is cancer and diabetes and heart disease and strokes. It's chronic illness. That's going to be 80% of the program. And I think I found some ways to get people better care at lower cost. And we're going to use one of your terrific retired physicians, you know, to help us thinking some of this through. Social Security is a different set, you know, of challenges. And I do support having the wealthy pay more into Social Security. There are some challenges in terms of how you do it, because the traditional rule with respect to entitlements, which is what Social Security is, if you pay more, you get more. Now, people historically have said, hey, if you got a millionaire, that's not exactly where you want to go with it. But on the basic proposition of should the most affluent in our society pay more into Social Security for the very reason you're talking about, my answer is yes. I'm the ranking Democrat on the committee that would be in charge of that.
Red 168.
Senator Wyden, thank you for being here. As a teacher, a parent, my question is relating to education. And these students who are getting ready to head off to college, and I have one student in college, one student who'll be there in a few years. I'm just wondering what's in the pipeline potentially to help out offset the cost of education beyond high school for these students, especially in the areas of student loans. You know, we're crippling our students with debt, and I'd like to hear, and I'm sure they would like to hear, what you see as the future. Where can we go with that to help out?
Good. And I think a little perspective on the college student loan situation is also important, because when I was coming up, and I was lucky to get a college basketball scholarship, college cost a lot, but it was not like putting a big boulder on a student's shoulders and saying you're going to carry this sucker around for the next 40 or 50 years. And that is actually true, because I've actually had to introduce legislation to make sure that older people don't have their retirement garnished, because they're still trying to get out, you know, from under student loan payments. So there are lots more loans today than there are grants and scholarships and the like, and it is very common, as you know, for students to come out with $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 worth of student loans, and sometimes even more if they're going to graduate school. So here are a couple of things that I've done. One, because tuition always seems to be going up, I've introduced a piece of federal legislation to say that if a state agrees to either freeze or lower tuition, the federal government would create an incentive for that and provide a federal payment in order to get the states to start stepping up. And that's been a particular problem in our state, where we have not seen really tuition assistance keep up. So that's number one. Number two, I strongly support the Oregon Promise and making sure that we get to every student a clear pledge that they're going to be able to get through college. It's a combination of the state and federal assistance. And at the federal level, what I want to do is have year-round Pell Grants, because if we have year-round Pell Grants, a lot of people would like to be able to get through school earlier. And then a third measure is designed to try to make sure that finally there's an incentive to hold costs down. And education is one of the few things that students are going to buy where there's no incentive to hold the costs down. So I've introduced a bill with bipartisan support called the Student Right to Know Before You Go Act. And what this would do would be, for the first time, tell you what graduation rates are, what debt levels are, what remedial education costs are. And for the first time, you could compare one school against another. So if you got school A over here doing great, high graduation rates, low remedial education, not much debt. School A is doing great. School B is doing bad. School B better clean up its act or it's going to go out of business, and school A will get those students until somebody comes along to beat school A. So this is a combination, it seems to me, of getting the state to step up, which is what I'm doing with my effort to get tuition frozen or lowered, a combination of making the best use of scarce resources, and that's why I'd like Pell Grants to be available year-round. And then finally, in order to create some incentives so you don't get clobbered right out of the gate with education costs, Know Before You Go would be the first effort to actually introduce some tools to start holding down costs for college. Those are the three things I'm working on now.
Blue 772.
And in the course of this morning, if students have ideas on other things they'd like, I'd like very much to hear it. Go ahead.
Blue 772.
So on the news this morning, Trump was talking about anonymous news sources and how he wanted everyone to put their name behind everything that's reported bad about him or anyone else. How exactly does that work in Washington, these anonymous sources, and are they true facts that they're putting up, or are they rumors to, you know, help their cause? How exactly does that work?
That would be a topic that would take a long time to give a full answer to. I mean, we have had statements that in the past would have been so jaw-dropping that people would have ridiculed it for days. I mean, we had people in the Trump administration talking about alternative facts, and they were arguing about how many people came to the inauguration, and some person said this and some person said, you know, said that. And I think two things. First, a free press is so important to this country. And the reason you know about Mike Flynn and his involvement with Russia is because of the free press. And because of the free press, and people like me are going to be asking for it, I want Michael Flynn to show up for an open hearing of the Intelligence Committee, raise his right hand, and tell the American people what is going on here. So I think it comes back again to this question of speaking out and pushing back when you hear something that doesn't add up. And I'll give you an example. A few Sundays ago, Kellyanne Conway, a leading advisor to Donald Trump, went on one of the talk shows, I think it was Meet the Press, and she said on that show, and she knew it was a busy news weekend, it was right after the Women's March, thank you all for marching, a lot of Oregonians were in those marches. She said on this busy Sunday after the march, she was talking about various topics, and she said, President Trump has no intention of ever releasing his tax return. And Chuck Todd looked a little surprised because this is kind of thrown into the topic. And she said, yes, it was litigated during the campaign, and the American people have decided that they're not interested in this issue. So it's 11 o'clock in the morning. And I said, I know exactly what this is. This is an effort to try on a busy news day to start slipping in other kind of, you know, alternative facts. So we got on the phone with all of the grassroots groups that we could find. There are lots of groups working for transparency and against secrecy and disclosure of the returns. And around 3 or so in the afternoon, I gave an interview to the Washington Post. That got a lot of circulation. I pointed out nobody I know voted in the election, whether they voted for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or somebody else. I don't know of anybody who voted to say, well, if somebody wins the election, no longer should we have the requirement of disclosing tax returns. That was absurd. And so we created as much noise as we possibly could. And on Monday morning, Kellyanne Conway told another what William Peter Wyden, my 9-year-old son, says, Dad, another whopper. And Kellyanne Conway said, nope, we haven't changed anything. There was no news yesterday. Of course, he's going to release his return after his so-called audit is over. But the point is that that's sort of what we're dealing with. We're dealing with alternative news and alternative facts and saying when you clearly tried to change something that you really didn't try to say something. And so put it up on the Oregon Way board. That's not the way we do it. We think they're real facts, not alternative facts. And we're interested in real solutions, not a bunch of fake this and fake that.
Red 165.
Hello, we're really glad you're here today. My question for you regards Betsy DeVos as the new education administrator and as us as students. Should we be concerned about our futures with any of that? Like, kind of what's going on in that game? It sounded better in my head, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I voted against Betsy DeVos. The reason that I did is that, as you all know, we have been first in so many things in Oregon. We're really proud of it. We've been first in high school graduation, we've been first in the environment and protecting the environment and so many things, but we've been at the bottom in terms of high school graduation rates. And I got legislation passed to really deal with that problem, where we could have mentors in the schools, companies could come in. If students wanted to work at a particular company, they could start working with them in high school, get course credit, and be on their way to a good paying, you know, job. So we've had real success in a number of approaches that could help raise the graduation rate. Well, I looked at the transcript involving Betsy DeVos's hearing, and I saw that with the private schools she invested in, she claimed that they had twice as high a graduation rate as they actually had. And I said, looks like more alternative facts. And that was a big consideration. So we did get our graduation rate amendment adopted. That was before the Trump administration came in. So I am really going to be bird dogging this, because this is not something we can be proud of, as being in the cellar with high school graduation rates. We're too good for that. And I think we've seen evidence of real approaches that could work. Now, to give, in all fairness, both sides here, in this debate about whether or not there was going to be discrimination against transgendered kids, Betsy DeVos, according to everything I've read, stuck up for the kids. And Jeff Sessions was the one who pushed it through. And I want you to know there are going to be a big bunch of us in the United States Senate who are going to push back. We're not going to sit around and let kids be discriminated against. That's not right. The Oregon Way is not about discrimination, because nobody is free unless everybody is free.
Blue 842.
Oh, you need to see my ticket. Well, one of my biggest concerns is climate change. And related to that, I'm concerned about the efforts that are going on to suppress family planning services, and particularly considering that the effect the population has on everything from poverty to global warming.
The Finance Committee, and I'm the ranking Democrat on it, Orrin Hatch is the chairman of the committee, is the committee that really pays for American health care, Medicare and Medicaid, and much of the tax assistance for the Affordable Care and program and the like. And family planning is particularly important, as, in my view, is reproductive rights. And I want you to know that on my watch, government policy is not going to deny women in America the opportunity to see the doctor they trust. Healthcare policy, as you've touched on a focus on preventive kind of services, and family planning, and the like, and it really ought to be driven by the choices that women make, not choices made by legislators in Washington, D.C., who are hostile to that. Now, with respect to climate change, a couple of things. First, I get up every single day and say, what are we going to do to put points on the board in the fight against climate change? Because if you look at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency numbers, there is a real problem here. So the question is, what do you do? And Oregon can uniquely contribute because we have everything from solar and wind and geothermal. And on the Oregon coast now, you probably know that in Newport, they got the biggest research grant ever to look at wave and tidal energy, you know, clean, renewable energy. And we got the Pacific, you know, ocean, you know, so close to us. So we ought to look every single day to put points on the board for the fight against climate change. Now, a little bit of breaking, kind of very interesting news. In the last week or so, three of the most eminent longtime Republican conservatives, George Shultz, Hank Paulson, and James Baker, Treasury secretaries, secretaries of state, chiefs of staff at the White House. I mean, these are as long-standing, prestigious names in conservative Republican circles have been up on Capitol Hill talking about the need for a carbon tax and a need for a serious effort on climate. That's pretty serious. Now, before everybody claps too much, here's the kind of thing they're going to be talking about. They're going to say, we believe in a market approach for climate change. We're interested in a carbon tax. But we know Republicans will say, if there's going to be a carbon tax, we get rid of a bunch of the regulations that have been used to limit carbon. Now people are going to have to think about that one. I think a lot of people would say, hey, great tax. I don't know about the other part. But that's kind of the nature of natural resources policy. And, you know, the point is, on these tough issues, nobody gets everything they want. Nobody gets everything they believe they ought to have. The question is the public interest, you know, met? And bipartisanship is not about taking each other's bad ideas. Anybody can do that. Bipartisanship is about taking good ideas. So we'll have to see if this adds up, this kind of concept. And I've not taken a position on it. And I just thought it was striking that a lot of people share your view who might not agree with everything else that you're thinking about in terms of politics and government, and that ought to be part of the debate. That's the Oregon way. That's the way we've done it when Democrats and Republicans come together. And bipartisanship should be about taking good ideas from each other, not about taking bad ideas.
Red 140. Red 140.
Are you accepting pictures after?
What a cool question. Apropos of a little Oregon history, I don't ever recall an instance where an Oregon elected official refused a picture. And I am not going to be the first. I'd love to do it. Stick around.
Shall we take another red question since that one was so short? Red 158. Okay, red 156.
So my question for you, so I'm a little bit worried about the transparency with our new administration coming in. And I wanted to see what your view is regarding the transparency of our new administration and how it's going to be dealt with.
Well, I think that there have been issues that people have been surprised on, and then there have been issues that haven't been surprised on. I'm sure you've heard, because we all love our pets, about these puppy mills. Well, the Department of Agriculture apparently had a list of the places that weren't up to satisfactory standards. It was information. That immediately was taken away. And so, and I don't pretend to be the most knowledgeable person on the planet about this, but a lot of people came to me and said, Ron, that's part of our transparency effort. And so we've led a big push to say, can't you get that information out? We've got scientists saying that they're worried about climate change information being suppressed. We heard about people at the Department of Energy early on being told about, you know, have you made visits or speeches or things with climate change. And I'll tell you, too many Americans have worked too hard to have government that's open and accountable. I'm the co-chair of what's called the Whistleblower Caucus. And this is one of the most important functions imaginable. And people always ask me, what can they do? If you know people who work in government or they work at a nonprofit that might receive some government funds and they're saying they'd like to speak out, they believe that the real facts aren't getting out about what's going on in their agency, I want you to send them to me, because that to me is what open and accountable and transparent government is all about. Good on you for asking the question. And of course, what's so exciting is through the net and social media, there's so many new ways to get this kind of information out. One of the things that I took away from that experience where we sort of pushed back on Kellyanne Conway saying that there wouldn't be any tax returns is that all happened on a Sunday. If you asked about government and information 15 years ago, it would have taken 2 weeks to wet your whistle and get in touch with people and the like. But on Sunday, largely through the social media, transparency, and folks around the country feeling like you do, that they want to have the real story get out, we reached so many eyeballs and people on a Sunday afternoon in the winter that we got it turned around by Monday. Now, it doesn't mean we're done. It doesn't mean we've got the tax returns. But the point is, it was an effort to make sure people had the facts. And using the social media is particularly valuable. And your generation is so savvy about all that. In fact, a few years back when there was the effort to really wreck the internet, do some of you guys remember that SOPA and PIPA effort? So tell everybody, I see a student nodding their head, what was SOPA and PIPA? Yeah, what was it? Tell everybody.
Well, I know that SOPA had to do with copyright infringement issues, so people would not be allowed to post fan fiction or fan art, and that was a very serious thing because it was considered like an infringement on people's rights in order to... I don't remember the specifics of it. I was a little too young. And
you did great. You just did great. So, a couple years ago, there was something called SOPA and PIPA, and she laid it out very well. The idea was a laudable one, and that was we shouldn't be rewarding piracy. You know, if you're stealing people's inventions and written material and stuff like that. That's wrong. We need to have restrictions for it. But all of the big lobbies, the Chamber of Commerce and all the big money groups, basically said, we're prepared to really do a lot of damage to the architecture of the internet, what's called the domain name system. Domain name system is basically the phone book for the internet. So all these powerful lobbies said, you know, the domain name system might be nice, but we're much more interested in fighting piracy. And a lot of people said, excuse me, you know, we think it's pretty hard to find something more valuable to all of us than a free and open internet. We'll work with you on fighting piracy. I introduced a bill that would not do the damage to the internet, but I put a hold on the bill to block this ill-advised PIPA and SOPA legislation going forward. And a vote was called, and everybody said, well, we're going to have a debate, and Ron's going to talk a little while, and, well, he's from Oregon, so, you know. And I said, I just want everybody to know that there are millions of Americans who spend more time online in a week than they spend talking about their congressperson in 2 years. And I don't believe they're going to be very happy. And the vote was scheduled for a Tuesday, right after a kind of work period. And on the previous Wednesday, 15 million Americans, largely led by young people, you know, who are online and were following this issue, texted, emailed, called, weighed in. And by the next day, I was told there wasn't going to be a vote because the grassroots had won. The grassroots had beaten some of the biggest communications lobbies and powerful interests in the world, and it was largely about your generation, guys. It was about students and young people who went online and said, just as you did, not a question of protecting, you know, copyright. We understand if you invent something that that's your intellectual product and it deserves protection and it is beneficial. Otherwise, you know, people's individual initiative isn't rewarded. But let's not harm the public at large in order to do it. So there you are.
Blue 798. 798.
You're definitely here, but the question is where? Oh, good.
I have a question about, we're a pretty active community here. I'm from Coast Community Radio. I'm here reporting, actually, but I want to ask a question.
Let's hear it for community radio. Oh, my God. Oregon loves community radio.
Thank you. We're a pretty active community, and all of us here, we're here to hear you, but we also want to know what we can do as citizens. Good. And so when we leave this meeting, how do we get the most bang for our buck? Because every day as a citizen, I see things falling on the national level that I don't seem to have any control over. So I guess, how can we best support you? How can we be active citizens in the best way possible in this environment?
Great. Let me kind of walk you through a few things that I think are helpful. And obviously, you're starting it right now by coming to meetings. And certainly when elected officials see you at a meeting, it's particularly meaningful because they see that this is a real person. Yes, texts and emails and tweets and all of that is very helpful, but we're getting to the point where we're getting so much of it that it's hard to make a judgment about, you know, was this a mass petition or was this or that or something else? So nothing really beats exactly what you're doing today, one. Two, the marches have been terrific. You know, I mentioned the Women's March. It was so powerful at just the right time. So meetings, marches. Telephone calls are particularly valuable, okay? For the same reason that the meeting is. It's a personal connection. And my favorite is if you hear about an issue where the key vote is going to come down to two or three senators in other states, it would be wonderful if you had a friend in one of those other states, somebody that was your roommate in college, you were in the wedding, you guys get together once every 5 years at the beach or whatever it is. If you called them and you said, you know, I've never made a call like this in all the years of our friendship, but there's this really big thing coming up, and your senator is going to be one of the people who decides it. And I think it'd really be in line with the kind of thinking and values we've had if you would give that senator in the other state a call. And those kinds of things really help, again, to create this kind of grassroots mobilization, this kind of grassroots juggernaut. And people are doing that. People who've had friends who've never talked politics before. I can tell you, how many of you have never been to a town meeting? I think I asked that once, right? Give me the hands again. This is happening all over Oregon, all over Oregon. And this is the way you change policy. Now, I have some other real favorites. I'm co-chair of the Whistleblower Caucus. I mentioned that. So when you, in fact, I'll go the next step. When you see somebody that you think I ought to be talking to because they have information and we ought to have it for the Whistleblower Caucus, let us know. Where is Fritz Graham? He's floating around here. Fritz and Ree are here from our office. Feel free to call them nights and weekends and take all their free time. But I'm very much convinced that, so I've gone through, I think, four or five things. And then, of course, institutions like community radio are really important because they're another low-cost way to create a kind of grassroots juggernaut. And what it really comes down to, the answer to your question, a very good one, really reflects my judgment about political change. I think political change very rarely is top-down, where it starts in a government building where a bunch of people in dark suits get together and say we're going to be for something really transformative. Sometimes, not very often. It's not top down, it's bottoms up. It's as people get mobilized all over the country and start speaking out about issues they care about. We've had, I think, 2,500 people at some meetings. This is a wonderful crowd on a cold Friday morning. In Sisters, the town has 2,000 people, and we had 800 people at the event. And I've never seen anything like this. I have never seen anything quite like this. And I'll tell you, y'all have been very nice to me, and I appreciate that. I think you've probably seen in the news, some of my colleagues in Congress are having meetings that aren't going so great. So, I hope that's responsive to your question, but that's the point. Political change is bottoms up, not top down. And use your community radio.
Yeah. Red 145. Red 145, Red 136.
Oh, hi. So you're very for, like, transparency and freedom of information and stuff like that. What's your stance on people like Edward Snowden and the people at WikiLeaks? Do you think it's important to get out
terrific
information
question.
That's maybe under wraps on purpose?
Terrific question. I've given this topic a lot of thought. Let me kind of walk you through it. You might have seen, because it's been in a bunch of the movies, it's in the Snowden movie, that after years and years of watching the intelligence leadership say one thing in public, and my knowing from private meetings that something else was going on. I spent close to 6 months preparing to ask the question that I'm going to describe to you. The intelligence leadership would say things like, "We don't hold data on Americans." That's what the former head of the NSA said. And I turned to my staff and I said, "That's one of the most false statements ever made in the history of American surveillance and intelligence policy," because as you know, and you learned later, the government was collecting all of this phone data on law-abiding Americans. It's called metadata. I'm sure you've heard a lot about that. So I listened to all these false statements, and in 2013, I spent 6 months preparing to ask the head of national intelligence this question in public. We only get about 45 minutes a year to ask questions in public, so I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I had listened to all these comments in private, and I asked the head of national intelligence, "Does the government collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?" And he said no, and that was a lie. And I had sent him the question in advance, by the way. We asked him to correct it after he said it. And Mr. Snowden has said several times that that for him was the tipping point. That's why he did what he did. Now, I made the rule a long time ago that I wasn't going to kind of do running commentary when an individual has been criminally, you know, charged. But what I will tell you about the Snowden matter that really disturbs me is that it really looks like there's a double standard, because Mr. Snowden is, you know, living thousands of miles away from his loved ones, and people like David Petraeus released information knowing that it was secret and classified and didn't get much of a punishment at all. So I'm very much opposed to this double standard, and we're working on that as it relates to whistleblowers.
Blue 685. Senator Wyden, thank you for coming to Astoria. And my question has to do with climate change and climate policy. And there is a, in Washington, D.C., on April 29th, there's going to be a march supporting climate policy and against the present administration's take on it, and the director of the EPA and all that's going on now. Do you plan to be either at that demonstration, that march, or one in Portland?
My wife says I usually don't know where I'm going to be 2 days from now, let alone April 29th. And I know April is going to be, we're going to be doing a lot of marching in April, because April 15th, we're going to have a big march that I've been asked to be one of the leaders on, apparently in Washington, D.C., to again push for disclosure of the president's tax returns. So I would sure like to be part of efforts on climate change, whether it's April 29th, whether it's here or in Washington, D.C. And then, of course, we got Earth Day coming up. And I mean, look, what you're doing is incredibly important, and I want to be part of as many of those grassroots efforts as I possibly can.
Red 136.
All right, so what are some of the biggest issues you think Oregon faces today? And then what are you most passionate about?
Question was big issues facing Oregon today. I want, in particular, to do everything I can to try to find those new economic opportunities, new possibilities for good-paying jobs, because I think we need fresh policies that are actually going to raise wages and raise people's pay. Because there are too many people working 2-3 jobs that aren't paying. So one of the reasons that I'm a big supporter of exports and trade, one out of five jobs in Oregon depends on international trade. And there are going to be a billion middle-class people in the developing world in 2020. And they love buying Oregon stuff. So my view is that if we can find industries where you can grow it here, make it here, add value to it here, and ship it somewhere, that's about at the top of my list. Because if there would be one kind of economic challenge, I want to find new opportunities for your generation, in particular students, to be able to stay in Oregon, have a job that you enjoy and you like that reflects a high level of productivity and knowledge and pays a good wage where you can support your family and live in the best place in the country.
Blue 763, Blue.
My question was already answered, but so I'll try for a new one. How are you going to approach issues protecting the health of the Columbia River from various efforts, because we're noticing more and more, and I'm trying to be very gentle with my question.
You're doing, I can answer real quick. Because we're going to have a big job watchdogging the EPA when it's headed by Scott Pruitt.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen some of the stories about the emails that have been coming out here in the last, couple of days, but the question is, with respect to environmental policy, what's going to drive environmental policy, the policies of the EPA? Is it going to be adhering to strong environmental standards, or is it going to be the wish list of these powerful special interests? That's the question, and watchdogging that agency is going to take a lot of our time.
Red 144.
Hi. My question is regarding cabinet members. Recently, Steve Bannon was appointed to the National Security Council, and a lot of other controversial cabinet members have been brought up. Tillerson, for example, he got an award from Putin and the Kremlin himself back in 2011 with the Russian ties with that. That's a liability in itself. I mean, Bannon, with Breitbart News, says it was a platform from the alt-right, which is a nice way of saying they're white supremacists, and he supports that. And personally, I don't want billionaires and people who support white supremacists leading my country, and I don't know what to do about that, and that kind of scares me.
What is especially troubling is how Mr. Bannon, in other words, the president initially took Mr. Bannon to be one of his advisors in the White House. And I obviously share a lot of your concerns with respect to his views. But it was one thing when he was an advisor inside the White House. It's altogether a different thing that somehow he has managed to be part of the National Security Council, because this raises questions about what the process is for naming somebody to the National Security Council. I want you to know, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, I'm going to be digging into this, because I think it's a real policy question that needs an answer.
Okay, these are going to be the last two questions. So first, Blue 688.
Hi, my name is Kim, and recently Jeff Sessions has come out to say that he wants to enforce laws against legalized marijuana in the states that have legalized it, and I want to know what we can do about that.
Well, I already spoke out against Sean Spicer's comments yesterday. You know, one of the most interesting parts of the political debate in America is so many of the people who talk about states' rights, and I always watch, we have the ability in our offices to watch what's going on the floor, and somebody comes down to the floor and they're wearing their nicest suit and they're all dressed up and they get puffed up and they talk, I'm here to say that we're going to talk about states' rights and the power of the states and the flawed ideas of the federal government. Sometimes you wonder why they want to be in the Senate in the first place, because, like, you know, there's nothing they really want to do at the federal level except take things away and give them for somebody else's job. But a lot of the people who say they're for states' rights really seem to be saying they're for states' rights if they think the state is right. It's a very odd kind of notion. And I've been one who have said that areas that have been traditionally left to the states, the reason we have our death with dignity law, and we're one of the few states we're one of the few states in America that does, is the House of Representatives and the people of Oregon. For you students who might not have heard about all this, the people of Oregon voted twice for death with dignity. And after the second vote, the House of Representatives in the Congress voted to get rid of what we had voted for. Okay, they had a vote, they had a big vote in the Congress to get rid of what we voted for. And I was pretty new to the Senate, and I said, you may think we're small, and you may think that we're off at the other end of the United States, but I want you to know, and I hadn't done it before, I'm going to filibuster this bill, because you are not going to roll the people of Oregon. And we managed to win. And that's why we have the law today. And the point really is, on the marijuana issue, this has been a matter of states making their own judgments. We've had a debate. We've had debated a long time. And the state has now voted to say that recreational marijuana is going to be legal. And I think there are questions continuing for the state. When the state legislators have asked me, I know there are questions about these food products and digestibles and all this kind of thing. So there are issues for the state to tackle. But that's not what Jeff Sessions was talking about. I think at one point he said, good people don't smoke marijuana. I think that's what he said. But the point is, this is an issue that has been left to the states. So you can see my comments online about all of that, is that I think that on issues that have traditionally been for the states, if you're serious about states' rights, show it now and respect the people of Oregon who've cast their votes. So, Cindy, is that the last one?
Last question goes to the students. Can you take one
more?
Sure,
of course.
Them?
Okay. And then I'm going to just leave you with one thought.
163. Hi. Under the new director of the Environmental Protection Agency, what can we do to protect our clean air and water?
Question was a great one. And the reason it's so important is clean air and water is practically in Oregon's gene pool. This is what we treasure. I mean, this is a big reason, for example, that a lot of companies want to come here or grow here, because their workers want clean air and water. It's one of the first things they bring up. And we're going to have to be very vigilant over the policies that are coming out of, you know, EPA. Already we've seen an effort to roll back some of the rules as it relates to water. I think it's clear they're going to try to roll back some of the climate change proposals, particularly the ones that, in effect, give states targets for how they're going to clean up the air. That's been the approach. This has not been a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. So we are going to have to play defense, number one, and that is to try to hang on to some of what we have, and then look at ways in which we can play offense. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I mentioned this exciting new research being done on the Oregon coast. I mean, if any of you want to volunteer on those kinds of projects, I mean, I think we're just really at the beginning of looking at the potential for the oceans and tidal and wave and the like. And so vigilance over the EPA and trying to come up with fresh creative approaches that are going to build support for broader kinds of reforms, I think that ought to be the agenda. You all right with that? Okay. So we've been at it for 90 minutes or thereabouts. There hadn't been a bad question in the House. Not one. Immigration. And you want to do immigration before we leave? Okay. I'm game. First thing I want you to know on the immigration issue is we must never, ever forget that we are a nation of immigrants. My parents fled the Nazis in the 1930s. Not all got out. We lost family at Kristallnacht and Theresienstadt. My father came to this country still in his teens and didn't speak English, taught himself English, and said what he wanted to do was be in the army of the new country that he loved so much. And the army was not much interested in my father, Peter Wyden, because he was really overweight and had really flat feet and seemed to have allergies and other things. And they kind of thought, Pete Wyden's kind of a mess. We're not much interested in him. But my dad talked his way into the U.S. Army because he wanted to write the propaganda pamphlets that we, the United States, would drop on the Nazis, tell them they better give up because they were all going to freeze, and Hitler didn't care about them. They were all going to freeze to death very quickly. So we Wydens are really patriotic. One, we believe in the benefits of immigration. And I can tell you that all over Oregon this week, I've been meeting youngsters, many of them Hispanic Americans, who want to serve in the military. And they're worried, based on some of these policies, whether they're going to have the opportunity to serve all of us. You've all been reading about the problems with translators and all kinds of other kinds of things. So this is really a fundamental question of who we are. And the Congress in the Senate passed an immigration bill a few years ago, and I voted for it. And I want to tell you how it works, because I still think it ought to be the foundation of what happens going forward. This, by the way, was based on what George W. Bush, a conservative Republican, and Ted Kennedy, a liberal Democrat, wanted to do. Okay? Didn't just fly out of the roof and land in Washington. Conservative Republican president, and obviously one of the leading liberals in the history of American politics. They said, let's do this. Let's strengthen what we're doing on the borders, because we all understand that the borders are crucial. Two, let's enforce the laws on the books. Let's say if an employer knowingly hires someone who is undocumented, they would face penalties and sanctions. We'll enforce the laws on the books. And there were other steps they took, and they said, let's deal with the biggest challenge, which is the 11 million people who are here in America undocumented today. And they said, if those individuals come forward voluntarily, pay a fine because the law was broken, show they have broken no other laws, show that they've mastered English, they ought to be given the opportunity to be citizens in America. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that's perfect, but we got a choice on immigration. And I'll close with this, and then we just want to leave you with one last thought. We have a choice on immigration. We can either keep playing the blame game in a system that is a broken, dysfunctional mess, or we can decide we're going to fix it on a bipartisan basis. That's what I voted for in the United States Senate. That's what I'm going to keep pushing for until we get it done. So, I told you what I thought of all of you, that there hadn't been a bad question in the House. And while the students are here, I'd like everybody to give them a round of applause because they did a terrific job. They did a terrific job. And for all of you students, I can tell you that it was clear that you have studied up on these issues. You came really well prepared. And for all of us adults, we're leaving knowing that we're handing the torch off to your generation, and you're going to do a good job with it. And here's my last statement. I'm sure you're going to walk out of here, you're going to disagree with me about one subject or two subjects, or maybe you're going to say, this guy doesn't know much about anything, which is, you're right. That's the nature of our system. What I hope you'll also say is this is the way the founding fathers wanted it to look. This is what they were hoping for in terms of how government would function, that people like yourselves, you know, raise important questions, that elected officials are held accountable, that we have more transparency. There aren't a lot of these meetings going on in America. You know, right now, I read a story, we're proud of being first. Apparently, this week, we're first in the nation in town meetings. That's my version. That's my version. That's my version of a first that really matters. And I can tell you, I do not have all the answers. I can cast a vote at 11 o'clock in the morning on the floor of the United States Senate. And at 12:30, I will get a call from Nancy B. Wyden, and she will say, you just blew that one, Buster. That was a really bad vote. And often she'll be right. But what I can tell you is this has been an extraordinary honor for me to have had this opportunity to represent Oregon in the United States Senate. My grandparents would be floored. They wouldn't even believe it, that their first generation Jewish grandson would have all these opportunities for public service. So I want you to know it's a tremendous honor to represent you in Washington, D.C., that this is a crucial time, which it's clear everybody in this hall understands because of the terrific attendance. And I want you to know if somebody brings up something that steps on Oregon values and what we've heard today, respect for freedom, you know, respect for transparency, good health care choices rather than the needs of lobbies, protecting the land, air, and water, and not going along with what big lobbies are talking about. If anybody tries to trample on those Oregon values, I will be pushing back every single step of the way. Thank you for being here. Thank you for doing what the founding fathers had in mind. Thanks, everybody. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.